Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, author of A Guide to Confident Living, meets psychiatrist Dr. Richard Hoffman and Pulitzer Prize winner James Michener on The Author Meets the Critics. Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, a battle about a book where outstanding authors are put to the severest test, meeting their critics face to face. And now meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Thank you, Bob Sherry, and a good afternoon, everyone. Our book today is A Guide to Confident Living by a distinguished clergyman, Dr. Norman Vincent Peale. Dr. Peale conducts the Art of Living program every Saturday evening here, which is heard over many of these NBC stations. You'll find Dr. Peale's book high on bestseller lists everywhere, wherever books are read, and the reason for its tremendous popularity seems obvious. It tackles in a straightforward, simple way a universal problem: how to be happy and successful. Dr. Peale examines first the causes of unhappiness and failure: tension, pressure, fear, emotional instability. He's describing me. All of these are the causes of our troubled minds in these troublous times. Now, I think, Dr. Peale, that you have to meet your critics on this presentation you've made, and allow me to introduce a well-known psychiatrist, author, and lecturer. We on The Author Meets the Critics remember him best for his sharp attack on the bestseller Peace of Mind, Dr. Richard H. Hoffman. Dr. Hoffman.
Dr. Peale, first of all, I want to tell you that I am endowed with a deep religious feeling, and that feeling, I believe, is the result of the impact of what little intelligence I have, plus my emotions, upon my experience. I believe with William James, that religion is an experience, that it's something that felt within and then projected without, that you can't get it by listening, that you can't get it by reading a book, no more than you can learn how to play a fiddle or paint a portrait by reading a book.
All right. There, Dr. Peale, is your first introduction to The Author Meets the Critics. Now meet your other critic with an altogether different attitude toward your book, winner of the Pulitzer Prize novel for 1948, Mr. James Michener.
Some years ago, a book was published which sold a host of copies. It was called What to Do Till the Doctor Comes. It explained what steps a man of ordinary sense could take to save himself. Dr. Peale has now written a book which might be called What to Do Till the Psychiatrist Gets You. Obviously, such a book is needed, for there are not in this world enough psychiatrists to care for all the minor cases of mental disruption. There are not even enough to care for the major breakdowns, and it behooves each of us to learn the simple rules of preserving mental health. This is especially true in the case of accumulating fear, what you and I call cracking up or losing our grip. Dr. Peale has written a book to help us in this job of holding the fort against mental disintegration. I want to make one point clear. Dr. Peale talks wonderful sense in this book. Much of it is founded upon sound psychiatric principles and says precisely what your doctor will say if you report to him with the beginning signs of crack-up. But Dr. Peale founds his case on more than mere medicine. He brings from the Bible those permanent truths that have helped men for 2,000 years. He is not shallow. He is not a reprimanding preacher yapping at you for your transgressions. He is not glib nor sanctimonious. He is helpful. And in today's world, we need help. All the help we can get. Lots of people are going to thank Dr. Peale for the sensible help he provides in this book.
Well, there, Dr. Peale, are two entirely different opinions on your book. In a little while, you, as the author, can strike back with full force. Now, I think that we should, however, get an idea of what your book is about. And A Guide to Confident Living, of course, is a how book, a book of instruction. And here's an idea of its scope from its chapter headings. How to get rid of your inferiority complex. How to think your way to success. How to be free from fear. How to attain married happiness. How to meet sorrow. How to avoid getting upset. And, of course, your answers, Dr. Peale, can be stated also in terms of your chapter headings, such as, don't keep your troubles to yourself. Prayer, the most powerful form of energy. Forget failures and go ahead. change your thoughts, and you change everything. Well, there in brief, I've tried to give through the chapter headings a synopsis of the theme of A Guide to Confident Living. And our author is with us, of course, and in a little while he'll tell us more about his book and answer the criticisms which will come from Dr. Hoffman. But now, Mr. Michener and Dr. Hoffman, you disagree profoundly on this book. One of you thinks it's good, one of you thinks it's bad. What do you think of Mr. Michener's analysis, Dr. Hoffman?
I think this. I remember a friend of mine, Edward Emerson Simmons, who was descended from the great Emerson, who said to me at one time that he'd written a sonnet to his soul, and it began as follows. Cross-hatched with many a shameful scar, and he said I couldn't go any further. That said it all. Now, it seems to me after reading this book that it says all when the Dr. Peel says, come to my church and be calm and be quiet and let the spiritual influences of the Almighty enter into you and you will be cured of your malady. For 35 years I have seen man when he was in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes. And if I could do that in 15 minutes of continued prayer, I'd tear up my diploma. The human being is afflicted with so many illnesses, so profound, so obscure, so torturing, that the way to them is not merely through one particular approach.
Well, Mr.
I remember, just a second, I remember a short story of de Maupassant's where, called Moonlight, where a priest who was told that his niece was having an unholy tryst by the edge of a river, went out to see whether it was true. And when he saw the young girl and the young man and the moonlight and the beautiful night and the silver stream, he felt that he had entered into a temple he had no right to enter. And I believe that when the clergy come into the domain of psychiatry, they are entering into a temple which they have no right to enter because they are not equipped with the knowledge that means anatomy, physiology, psychology, pathology, all of which may beset a human being. All life is built on a tripod of which has three stanchions: security, loyalty, and love. Break any one of them, and you have a tortured human being.
Well, I think Mr. Michener would like to break the one of love right now.
Mr. McCaffrey, I've heard several critics on this program whom I accused of reading between the lines, but this is the first one I've met accused of not even reading the lines themselves. There is in this book of Dr. Peel's substantial evidence on every side that he is simplifying the basic rules of psychiatry, not relying merely on religion, not relying merely on a bland smile and a warm handshake, but giving you fundamental psychiatric truth about how to get over the rough spots of life.
There are no basic rules for psychiatry. A psychiatrist is like a portrait painter. He looks at the person who comes before him. He sees his whole life as his background. Then he sees the individual. And then when he feels like it, he can get something out of him that might prepare him for a better life. There's no rule. Anyone who works by rule in psychiatry is a mathematician. There's no arithmetic to health. There's chemistry. There are four horsemen to the apocalypse. There's the physical, the chemical, the psychical, and the spiritual. And unless you ride all four horses, you will not benefit your patient for all time and eventually. We read in this
to defend himself, Dr. Peel.
Dr. Hoffman says that if he could go into a church and in 15 minutes of prayer get his life completely changed, he would tear up his diploma. Well, and all I've got to say is he might as well start tearing it up. Because I have seen that happen time and time and time again. And I've seen it happen when men have spent a lot of time with psychiatrists. They've come down to the church and through this spirit thing we call conversion or spiritual chain, I've seen people delivered of everything.
I'd like to know what mental picture you have when you say spiritual change.
Well, I don't know that I could define that. It's a very difficult thing to define, except that I would say that their whole mental attitude seems to change at once. Now, it may be even deeper than that.
I can define it. It's very well defined, Dr. Peel, in the story of the conversion of St. Paul. Those things happen. You speak in the first part of your book about the process of a religion in which I have at times been quite interested, the silence of the Quakers, whereby the inner light is supposed to strike a man. Now, I think we should get back to my opening statement that there are two kinds of people here. There's the doctor who is skilled in handling actual cases of mental breakdown, and there's the man who helps ward off those cases. I don't think, as I read your book, Dr. Peel, that you would be assume to treat a man who had actually collapsed nervously and should be in the hands of a doctor. You're talking about those steps which lead up to that, in which friendship and love and religion and help and everything else can forestall.
I appreciate you bringing that up, and I also thank Dr. Hoffman for pointing out that the minister has no right to come into the temple of psychiatry. He is perfectly right about that. And in my own work, some years ago, realizing the limitations of my own knowledge, I'm merely a plain pastor, that's all. As in my consultation, I saw that many of these problems went far deeper than my knowledge took me. I found an eminent psychiatrist in this city, Dr. Smiley Blanton. I asked him to join forces with me. When a person comes to our clinic, all psychiatric work is done by Dr. Blanton or his associates, and we merely look to them for understanding of factors about human nature which we've never been trained. We always remember, and every minister should remember it, he is only a minister. He is not a doctor or a psychiatrist. He is only a pastor. We make that clear.
In other words, Dr. Hoffman, there is no attempt here to cut off your practice at all by
Dr.
Beale.
I wish they did. I've really got too much to do at the present time.
Well, the difference is Dr. Hoffman can charge a fee, and all we get is an invitation to lunch.
A good lunch, I trust, Dr.
May I take a specific chapter here, because I think this relates to the whole problem. The chapter on how to be free from fear. As I recall it, first Dr. Peel establishes what we all know, that the world is in an age of fear. Then he gives the best medical advice taken from the advice of men who have studied the problem medically, chemically, physiologically, on how to relax. Now, this is not somebody's cooked-up dream. This isn't Dr. Peel's study thoughts about how to relax. It's good medical advice. And then, here is the clincher, he quotes biblical passage to show that religion, too, is on this side, for he concludes, "For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power, and of love, and of sound mind." And that seems to me an awfully good approach. State the problem, state what medicine believes about it, and then put your clincher in for those people who cling to religion as their hope with what religion says about it.
Dr. Hoffman.
One of the most trenchant maladies in life today is fatigue. And fatigue leads to apprehension, and apprehension to distortion. And accompanying this particular change in physiology and psychology, there are chemical changes. Our blood sugar gets low. We then throw out adrenal secretion to go to the liver and to convert the glycogen into blood sugar. And for the time being, we feel better. Unless an individual is studied from those particular standpoints and you don't know why the fear came, how can you treat an effect without knowing the cause? This seems to me almost to be like a pseudo-hypnosis, a suggestion, as Mesmer did with about 70,000 hysterics in Paris until they were worn out, until they were used up, and then they found out that his touching him with a metallic rod didn't work. I'd like to know some of the failures that the doctor had. All he mentions are successes. I've had failures, lots of them. I'm going to send him some of mine.
Dr. Peel?
Well, we'd be very glad to have them. I imagine we could do something about them. I think the criticism is valid. If I had to write the book over again, I might refer a little more adequately to the failures. We do have failures. I talked to a psychiatrist in Rochester the other night at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked him what his percentage of successes were in connection with alcoholism, and I think he said 14%.
I think we can strike a higher percent than that, but I think together, psychiatry and religion can strike an even higher percent.
Well, alcoholism is the symptom of a disease, not the disease itself.
Well, but I suppose that Dr. Peel's statement was a rather simple one, like you might talk of other symptoms of other diseases, and if you say treating them, you weren't talking about treating the causes. But, Dr. Peel, what were you trying to do, since Dr. Hoffman doesn't seem to agree with what he thinks you are trying to do in the book? What were you trying to do in writing this Guide to Confident Living?
Well, I was trying to show that religion is maybe misunderstood. A lot of people think of it as a theology.
There's a considerable amount of evidence that has never been understood, isn't there,
Dr.
Peel? Oh,
and a lot of things about it I don't understand, which is a terrible admission. But usually we think of it as a theology or as a philosophy. I think that there's a good ground for thinking of it as a science. In other words, that it's based on law. Laws about human nature. Laws of the spirit. I think that the New Testament and the Old Testament, too, are filled with techniques, formulas, which are will work when they're worked. And I'm led to that conclusion because these principles that are laid down in this book, and they're certainly written very simply, have been worked successfully by so many people that I know that they're effective. Why they work, I'm sure I haven't the slightest idea. I know the techniques that are taught by the New Testament, but I don't know how an alcoholic who has been licked and defeated and fired from his job and dirty and with no power whatsoever, I don't know how he can come into a church and suddenly get hold of something that completely releases him. Well, but I've seen it happen.
One of the things that bothered me in reading your book, Dr. Peel, was the constant emphasis on the book on success. I can think of a chapter on power and efficiency. And I worry a little bit about words like power and efficiency in our day because we have seen so conspicuously abuses, particularly of power. And throughout your entire book, there is no criticism of any of the standards of success which we might have today, but a considerable emphasis on the fact that this might help you to attain success. In other words, it seemed to me that your book might produce a highly successful corporation executive. I am not so sure that that would always produce a good Christian. Many corporation executives are very good Christians, and some are not. I don't think that the two are necessarily synonymous. What about your attitude throughout the entire book on success?
May I comment on that, Mr. McCaffrey? In a world in which 9/10 of the influences one meets are destructive influences, I don't think that a man like Dr. Peel, who is writing a book to counteract that, has to go in and define his terms. I think that anything he can do to help any of us is a positive asset. I, too, was troubled by the problem you raise, and I concluded that here is one man representing an established religion, a church, probably like most churches, without too many funds, representing 1/10 of society. He is constructive, and there is very little in society these days that the average man runs into that is constructive of that force. Therefore, if he can help the man do whatever the man wants to do, it's an asset. If he can help the man to hold his mind together, if he can help the man keep his nerves from flying apart, if he can help the man to keep married to his wife, if he can help the man make a success in living, those things are such a contribution that I think you've got to accept it on that basis. Then I think that Dr. Peel has another area of his mind entirely in which he deals with what should be the aims of success and what should be the aims of a good life. He has not described them in this book, but I don't think that is what this book is about. I think this book is about a grain of help in the midst of a ton of defeat.
Dr. Peel?
Thank you, Mr. Mitchner. That's expressed far better than I can do it. I perhaps have the old traditional American idea that it's a good thing for anybody to make as much of themselves as they possibly can.
We all agree here at this table, I'm sure, Dr. Peel.
And I've never felt that making money necessarily was an evil thing. Unless it's done on the basis of evil practices and dishonesty, which, of course, we do not advocate.
Certainly not.
I think my main idea was to teach people, or try to teach people, that through faith
and prayer, they can think positively, not negatively, and that they can overcome all their problems and their difficulties and make something of their lives.
Dr. Hoffman.
I think that the doctor forgets the impact of his own personality. I believe that if I went to see him when I was in distress, as I once went to see my dear old friend Alan McCurdy, and he helped me more than any psychiatrist ever could. But I don't think you can put it down on the printed page and have a man help himself by stating, in a superficial way, case histories. Case histories take hours to take and to define and to determine and to understand and to find out whether they're true or not. Because a great many people rationalize when they tell you a case history. Look at the Kinsey Report. You don't believe that all those things are true. They cannot be. So I say that I will go to the church and I will meet the doctor personally when I am in distress. But I can't do it by reading the book. I mean, I cannot get solace from reading the book. I tried to, just as I got no solace from peace of mind. I want no peace of mind. I want restlessness of mind leading to peace, a dynamic force. And I don't think that by merely shutting the window that lets in the draft, that you stop the storm outside.
No, Mr. McCaffrey, you're making it too simple, Dr. Hoffman. Here you live in a complex world in which a thousand influences impinge on you every day. There's the sound of the subway. There's the sound of birds in the morning wakening up when you want to sleep. There's the problem of paying your bills. There's the problem of are you going to get fired. There's the problem of war, the atomic bomb, what you're going to do next year. And out of that, it seems to me that anything which helps you attain security and friendliness and love and relaxation is a good thing.
You mean by 15 minutes of silence?
I certainly do mean by 15 minutes of silence.
Just as they did in the old Hindu religion, sit back there and meditate and believe they were in nirvana.
Isn't this, gentlemen, the whole argument of ends and means? After all, no one here at this table would deny, for instance, that reading the Sermon on the Mount or hearing the Sermon on the Mount, which probably took considerably less than 15 minutes to deliver, had a profound effect upon people's psychological attitudes as well as their spiritual life. My question is this the book which would do that?
The Sermon on the Mount is really my whole philosophy.
Well, evidently reading something influenced you then, Dr. Hoffman.
Why, not only reading it, but living it. That is the point. Not living, believing in God, but living so God believes in you.
Dr. Peel?
I think Dr. Hoffman and I are having a terrible time to disagree with each other here. If I were in difficulty, I certainly would go to him. And I would read anything that he had written, as I have, indeed, and gotten ideas from it and new slants. I think if we were to follow his suggestion there, nobody'd ever read anything. Why have books?
Well, read the poets. They sense the truth before the scientist proves it.
Well, I think you might compare this with a good many people in your tradition, Dr. Peel. And perhaps they said it a little more strongly. I can think, for instance, of George Herbert and John Donne, who were two magnificent Protestant divines. You can think of Donne's poem, Ending Death, Thou Shalt Die. Or you could even think of Johann Sebastian Bach, that when he chose to write music, he would write it to Martin Luther's great words, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. I am not sure that the prayers reproduced here by some of these people that you tell us have found these minutes of silence very effective stand up very well in terms of people who had a tremendous religious inspiration.
No, now wait. This book is not setting out. Let's get the limit of the book. The book is not setting out to be a new Marcus Aurelius. The book is not setting out to be the foundation of a new religion. The book is telling the story of one minister in one big city, in one church, showing what he could do to help a handful of people out of a whole mass of people thrown into this city. And what one man can do is terribly important. Because somebody here a minute ago said, if I were in need of help, we're all in need of help. The whole darn society is in need of help. If the psychiatrist can help, fine. If the minister can help, fine. If the writer can help, fine. If the businessman can, fine. But don't limit the book by saying, this isn't a pattern for a perfect world. This book is not the end of psychiatry. Certainly it's not the end of psychiatry. It's one man's story of what he did to help other people, and that seems to me of tremendous importance.
I would in one sentence like to say this, that I believe that the book shows that the toe of the psychiatrist is so near to the heel of the clergyman that he steps on his bunion, or as Shakespeare said, galls his kibe.
May I say this?
Yes, Dr. Peel.
I've been in this town of New York City for 16 years. I've lived here through a depression and a war. And I've seen people licked. I've seen them filled with tension and fear and worry and anxiety. I used to preach poetical, theological, and philosophical sermons. And I saw them still defeated. So I said to myself, there must be some way that you can help these people. And I wanted with all my heart to help them. I didn't know enough to help them entirely. Therefore, I brought a psychiatrist into my church, and we worked together, and we established certain simple principles, as Mr. Michener has said, and they work. And that's really all that matters to me. I wasn't trying to be a William James or a St. Bernard or anybody.
I want to make one elaboration on that point. Dr. Peel says they established certain principles. I want to repeat that those principles are the principles both of good sound medical practice, enough sleep, relaxation, how to relax your muscles at the end of the day, plus the principles found in the New Testament. That seems to me an awfully good combination.
I just want to say that I once wrote a book, and I was referred to as making money. The book made no money. I made my money writing prescriptions. I do much better on those, and they needn't be legible.
It seems you're
intelligible.
Once again, we get back to ends and means. Are you prepared to say, Mr. Michener, that you say anything which helps is good? But can anything help finally? I mean, you, Dr. Peel, for instance, is concerned about means. You're concerned about means. You, for instance, would not occupy yourself writing penny dreadfuls. Dr. Peel would presumably not run a holy roller or a Roman Catholic church. There is a concern about means.
Mr. McCaffrey, that's an awfully mean question you asked, and I'm going to have to answer it this way. At this stage of my life, I actually do believe that anything that helps for goodness is good of itself, and I don't look behind it anymore.
Same here.
And
that's good religion.
Absolutely.
Well, let me reiterate then that I feel that one of the great necessities is to look behind everything to find out whether it's really good. Are you willing to accept everything blindly?
I'm willing to look behind myself, these things. I'm willing to look behind my own motives. But if I get stuck and a man is there putting his hand out, I'm not going to look behind to see what's on his back. I'm going to save myself then. Then I'll go on to my introspection.
When you look behind yourself, do you ever see Satan?
Often. Far too often.
I'm surprised to find that coming from you, Dr. Hoffman, because I thought in your media it was always little men that you saw following behind you. Dr. Peel.
Well, I feel as Mr. Michener does. I will draw truth wherever I find it. And I get a great deal of help from some of my Catholic friends, my Jewish friends, certainly from my Quaker friends. And I've tried to take all that I could find and put it together in a book that's going to help people regardless of whether they're Presbyterians, Hottentots, or Methodists.
Hope that you found a little bit of that truth then here, Dr. Peel. I'm sure we have, but I'm sorry, gentlemen, the time is up for both the author and his critics. And here's Bob Sherry to give you a preview of our next book on The Author Meets the Critics.
On Tuesday next, all Americans we know, except one, turn their eyes on the All-Star baseball game at St. Louis. Our singular friend is Russell Maloney, who despises the nation's greatest pastime. Mr. Maloney has read a book called Baseball by Robert Smith, and he thinks it's nonsense about nonsense. Bill Veeck, president of the Cleveland Indians, thinks Russell Maloney is, well, to put it politely, misguided. And Mr. Veeck is a tactful gentleman. He's the man who hired babysitters for parents attending his night games. Mr. Maloney, on the other hand, is tactless on the subject of baseball. So be sure to join us next Sunday when critics Russell Maloney and Bill Veeck tangle on Baseball by author Robert Smith. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Dr. Norman Vincent Peel for coming here today to discuss A Guide to Confident Living, and to thank you, James Michener and Richard Hoffman, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Arthur Austin. This program came to you from Radio City, New York. This is Bob Sherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.